This is a CBC podcast.
Rolling Stone magazine gives The Social Network 4 stars.
Welcome to Facebook.
It's better than the movie of the year. It defines the decade.
This is our time.
Film Comment calls The Social Network an instant classic. The Social Network starts October 1st.
It's spring 2001. Workers for Fisheries and Oceans Canada back a truck up to a dam on the St. Croix River in St. Stephen, New Brunswick. Less than 75 meters from the U.S. shore, they start loading live fish into an aerated tank on the back of the truck. Then they drive 20 minutes upriver along a series of back roads until they reach a second dam, one that powers a pulp mill on the other side in Maine. They pull up to a pond above the dam and release the fish back into the river. In doing this, Canada is intentionally breaking a law passed by the government of Maine, a law designed to protect one species of fish to the detriment of another. I'm Pauline Dakin. Welcome to Maritime Magazine. That incident was just one chapter in a long, painful history for the fish in the back of that truck, known by some as Gaspereau or alewives to people who live along the St. Croix River. This morning, the CBC's Connell Smith tells us how the lowly alewife became the center of a dispute over how to manage resources on a beautiful body of water that forms a living boundary between us and our closest neighbor.
Might mind your head here and there.
I'm rooting around in the attic with Tony Reeder in his rambling heritage home overlooking the St. Croix River.
Oh, my goodness. There's my sail for my canoe there. See the sail up there?
Yeah.
My mast.
Tony's a retired teacher, amateur historian, and avid canoeist.
I haven't used it for so long.
He is looking for a scoop net he made long ago to snatch the once plentiful alewives from a stream below his home.
Oh, frig. Oh, I guess I must have chucked it. I haven't done it, you see, for 25 years. Understand?
When I first came here, a teenager came up to me and said, "Mr. Reedy, you've been down for the Elwies." I said, "The Elwies?" I said, "Elwies? What are Elwies?" "Oh," he says, "it's a lovely fish you get in the spring of the year. We net them down at the Denny Stream, down the lower end of town." So I said, "Oh, isn't that interesting? Well, I'll have to try. I live nearby." So I said, "Elwie?" I said, "Alewife. Sounds like a fish that I've heard about." And sure enough, it was the same fish that what you call up on the St. John River, the Gaspereau. Exactly the same fish. French word up there, English word down here. So we're living in no man's land, right?
No man's land. The St. Croix that has fascinated Reeder for much of his life is not Canada's river entirely, nor does it belong to America. There is evidence of 4,000 years of settlement here by native cultures. The river begins in the Appalachian Hills and winds its way out with lakes and narrows and rapids, past forests and rocks and glacial deposits, to the ocean. For much of the past 2 centuries, the people on its opposite shores have moved back and forth easily, working and trading and marrying and raising families. They shared the river. But in recent decades, Tony's watched as the St. Croix has changed into something more like the border that it is.
Oh, there are formal rules now, thanks to the American authorities. And traditionally, of course, you could, if you were making a canoe trip, the boundary runs right down through the middle of the river. So there are a lot of campsites on both sides. And you could camp whichever was convenient. But you can't do that anymore, because if you are a Canadian and you're caught camping on the American side of the river, even in the wilderness, and the authorities find out you're there, and they're flying over with a plane sometimes, and they've got ground people there, if they can get at you, you could end up in court in Machias, you know, entry unpermitted.
Alewives, or Gaspereau, are members of the herring family. Their lives are divided between the Atlantic Ocean, where they spend the winter months, and inland lakes and rivers to which they migrate in the spring to spawn. Like salmon, they're imprinted to return to the place where they hatched. They're also an important source of food for cod, haddock, and other groundfish that linger close to mouths of alewife rivers. In recent decades, first the alewives and then the groundfish disappeared along much of the eastern seaboard. In 1995, the government of Maine passed a law titled An Act to Stop the Alewives Restoration Program in the St. Croix River. The river may have its American and Canadian sides, but Maine's law effectively lets the state control what happens in the entire river system. It's able to do it because of the dams.
That's an island right there, and over there is Canada. And
Jay Bowden is environmental superintendent for Woodland Pulp and Power of Baileyville, Maine. His employer owns three important dams on the St. Croix and is under order by the state government to keep this fish ladder at Grand Falls Dam closed so that not a single alewife can pass. Woodland Pulp workers do it by placing a 21-inch board across the ladder entrance.
And the theory is that salmon and bass and fish of that nature that will use the fishway will jump over this board, but an alewife trying to come up the river will meet the board and not be able to jump over it. So what's been done since the mid-1990s is the state of Maine legislature has ordered us to put this blockade in.
It took only 5 years after Maine began blocking the river for the alewife population to plunge from 2.6 million to fewer than 1,000. Harvey Miller is Area Director for Fisheries and Oceans Canada.
When we saw the numbers down to 900, Fisheries and Oceans Canada wanted to ensure that these fish weren't what we call extirpated from the river, as these fish are imprinted to come up that river, and if we lost them, that would be a huge loss. So we started to truck the fish, some of them up around past Woodland, and so that they could get into that little extra habitat.
So how did we get to a situation where an important native fish is blocked by law from reaching its spawning grounds? For the answer to that, I went to Forest City, Maine, on the St. Croix's Grand Lake, where the sport fishing is legendary and money from high-paying anglers buoys the local economy. The smallmouth bass is a European import, introduced into the river system more than 100 years ago. The St. Croix's upper lakes are renowned among anglers, the vast majority of them working with guides and staying at lodges on the U.S. side of the border. The fishing is so good, the lodges actually advertise that an angler can hook 100 bass in a single day. The guides don't want anyone messing with that kind of success. And they believe they have proof alewives are bad for smallmouth bass.
It's a political battle. They're going to have us on welfare so that they can have the river.
Lance Wheaton is a legend among Maine guides, as was his father and grandfather. When not at the stern of a Grand Lake canoe, he's building one, by hand, in his spacious workshop.
This paddle will be a good one, you can tell by the grain of the ash coming down through.
When Lance began fishing, he didn't have to think about alewives. Dams on the river prevented them from reaching the St. Croix's upper lakes. Things changed with the construction of modern fish ladders in the early 1980s. Suddenly, alewives began to appear in his precious angling lakes. To Lance Wheaton, it was like seeing something exotic and foreign.
And they would come around some grass on a point, and you would see them with a big swirl in the water. Well, we saw the swirl, but we didn't see the fish. They were so fast that you said, oh boy, that must have been a bass. And then we realized it didn't act like a bass.
Lance makes no bones about it. Alewives have no business in the St. Croix system.
You can't catch it on a hook and line half the time anyway. You can't eat it. It's no good to eat. But they're using it for some kind of bait or something else, cat food or some damn thing. You know, I just feel that we owe it to our children of New Brunswick and Maine and everywhere to restore and keep this system natural.
There was no problem finding a suspect when the smallmouth bass population in the St. Croix's Spednik Lake temporarily crashed.
So we brought in biologists from Maine and New Brunswick, and we saw underwater large numbers of young of the year alewives along with anadromous alewives that had come in. And through the next 10 years in the studies, the depletion of the fisheries of Spednik, there had to be a reason for it. And the studies of netting the alewives and taking samples determined that that was the reason of the slow die of the lake.
Oh, you bum.
Maine, home base to retailer L.L. Bean, has a glorious past with fishing and hunting. The wise and seasoned guide enjoys a special status. State politicians were easily convinced that the St. Croix, with its rapids and waterfalls, couldn't possibly have been an alewife river to begin with. It didn't matter that in the state's own archives, there is ample evidence the fish has a long association with the St. Croix. In 1822, people in Calais, Maine, protested to the government that early dams were preventing alewives from making their 100-mile migration upriver to spawn. The state immediately responded with a law requiring the construction of fish ladders. But that was then. 16 years after it was passed, Maine's modern alewife law remains in effect. The fish has less than 2% of its potential spawning habitat. Thanks in part to Canada's effort to foil the state of Maine's law and a later compromise in which the state agreed to open a few more miles of the river, the alewife population has inched back from the brink, from 900 fish to about 60,000. The other good news is that alewives are gaining a lot of friends, and not just in Canada. Take Jerry Cushman. Alewives are the preferred bait for Maine's 5,000 lobster fishermen. And with the potential to support as many as 30 million fish, the St. Croix is the granddaddy of alewife rivers in eastern North America. Jerry, a lobsterman from Port Clyde, Maine, wants it opened.
That's just... You know, you're preventing a fish from naturally wanting to do what it wants to do. You're preventing that. That's not right. You're playing God. To me, we're not here to play God. We need to allow them fish to do what they want to do. When we do that, they'll thrive, in which they should thrive. We shouldn't try to wipe out a fishery. That's not what we're here for.
Jerry Cushman says he'd use between 1,500 and 2,000 bushels of alewives every year as bait, if he could get it.
Yeah, well, you got 5,000 lobstermen that are depending on alewives. You got 1,500 ground fishermen. This is just the state of Maine that are dependent on alewives. And the guides are preventing us from getting our bait. They're taking food off our table. They're stopping us from providing a living for our family because they don't think alewives belong there, in which we know that they belong there. I think there's proof that alewives have historically been there. There's no proof that alewives affect the population of bass.
But it's the alewife's potential to restore the inshore ground fishery that is most intriguing.
The codfish, the pollock, the haddock are dependent on alewives. These are fisheries that the stock was depleted. We need to bring them back, and they're depending on alewives.
And across the state of Maine, there are initiatives to open rivers and improve fish ladders so that alewives can thrive once again. Environmentalists have been particularly outspoken when it comes to the St. Croix alewives and to the actions of their government.
It's a story of personalities. It's a story of misinformation.
Landis Hudson is the executive director of Maine Rivers, a group that fights for the restoration of the state's waterways.
It has the potential to have the largest alewife run not just in Maine, but on the eastern seaboard. So it's a very large river, and if you look back at the history, it has had runs in the millions of alewives. So
the question, though, is who has authority over the St. Croix? How is it that a state government can take control over an international river and get away with it for 15 years?
On the invasive species issue, there is no question. We've got to shut the door.
Many believe this group, the International Joint Commission, has ultimate authority. The IJC was set up more than 100 years ago to iron out disputes on waterways shared by the U.S. and Canada, such as the Great Lakes and the St. Croix River. In 2009, three organizations, the Atlantic Salmon Federation, Maine Rivers, Landis Hudson's Group, and the Natural Resource Council of Maine, gathered the support of almost 50 other environmental and non-governmental groups from both Canada and Maine. They asked the IJC to use its authority to reopen the river.
The International Joint Commission does have jurisdiction over this boundary water, and that they have the authority that they can exercise to make this happen.
Jeff Giffen is with one of the groups, the Atlantic Salmon Federation in New Brunswick.
So I guess where we, you know, also take exception to this whole thing that occurred in 1995 that caused the alewife population to collapse is that you're protecting supposedly protecting a non-native species like the smallmouth bass and blocking out a native species, which is absolutely critical to the proper functioning of the entire river system and its ecosystem.
In the fall of 2010, the IJC offered a compromise. It would open the lower parts of the St. Croix, giving the alewife access to about 27% of its potential spawning area. But even that would depend on what happened to smallmouth bass. If bass numbers start to fall, the number of alewives allowed to pass upriver would be cut. Few seem to like the plan. The Maine guides because it lets the fish back into some of their bass lakes. Others don't like it because it doesn't allow the alewives into all the waters.
People have firmly held beliefs about the interaction between smallmouth bass and alewives that has not been scientifically proven. It's a firmly held belief that is not substantiated scientifically.
What we firmly believe is that these fish can coexist very well, the alewives and the smallmouth bass. That one doesn't, you know, the Gaspro alewives don't pose a threat to the smallmouth bass.
Okay. Well, we're working on the, we're trying to do a collaborative approach on managing, you know, the fish species in the river, especially as we're talking about the Gaspro.
One important player is embracing the IJC plan, however, and that's the Government of Canada, DFO's Harvey Miller.
You know, it's something that we work together on. We realize that, you know, there's differing opinions and on the state of the Gaspro and how they should be managed. So we're working together. We want to work with, you know, with people, and this is the way that we're moving forward. And
Miller admits DFO's hope is that the entire river system, with its 2,400 square kilometers of spawning ground, will eventually be open to alewives. And that's precisely why Maine guides fear the IJC plan. They see it as the thin edge of the wedge, a gamble. Sure, there are cases where smallmouth bass and alewives occupy the same lakes, but those lakes aren't these lakes.
It would take a real poor guide not to catch 80 fish a day. You could catch many more fish, depending on the day. If you had big wind and stuff and couldn't get in where they were working, you know, you wouldn't catch as many. But in good weather, popping bugs or fishing the bass tackle, you know, you could come out with a lot of fish.
So, lots of one kind of fish, none whatsoever of the other.
Jack, you're going to put on a pot of coffee. Would you like one?
Tony Reeder and I give up looking for the homemade alewife net. He hasn't used it in 25 years and figures it must have been thrown out. But he'd love to see the fish teeming in that stream near his home once again.
And I went out there one evening, when the tide has brought them in, an incoming tide, and the seagulls are flying overhead and squawking. There was an Indian fellow and his wife, and they had a wicker basket, and he was standing, the rapids were running between his legs away, and the fish were coming up, and he had that facing it, and his wife was standing at right angles with a potato sack, and he was scooping them up and pouring them into the sack, just like that. And they were there for about 10, 15 minutes, and they must have got, you know, 40 pounds at least of fish to go take home. I said, wow, that neat.
Listening to Maritime Magazine on CBC Radio 1. I'm Pauline Dakin. Connell Smith brought us this morning's story, and he is in our St. John studio now. Hi, Connell.
Hi, Pauline.
So where do things stand with the alewife dispute now?
Well, it still has not been resolved. The International Joint Commission floated that management plan for alewives as a trial balloon last September. There was immediate protest from guide groups in Maine and from environmentalists who said, what's going on? You're only opening part of the river, and even then you're holding alewives that can enter that area hostage to smallmouth bass, which is not even a native fish. So we had this controversy, and the IJC doesn't like controversy, so it immediately backed off. The commission wants to do more consultation in hopes that some kind of consensus can be reached. The problem, of course, is that there is no real middle ground on this particular issue. And meantime, 98% of the alewife's potential spawning area remains closed.
So the dispute's been going on for years now, decades even. What are the chances it will ever be resolved?
Well, groups like Maine Rivers and the Atlantic Salmon Federation believe it is inevitable that the river will be reopened. The weight of the science is overwhelming. There's growing awareness among people in Maine who are interested in the environment. And groups like the lobster fishermen and the ground fishermen in Maine are just starting to get riled over this. And those guys have their own local elected members of the state legislature. So something may develop there. But I talked to a scientist in Maine, a marine biologist, and he said that a simple chat between Prime Minister Harper and President Obama would solve this problem in the blink of an eye. And he said he'd prefer that that happen sooner rather than later.
That may not be our Prime Minister's number one priority on the bilateral agenda at the moment, eh?
I guess he's thinking about a lot of other things, but if it was on his agenda, I think it would get solved.
Yeah. Connell, thank you for this.
Thank you, Pauline.
The CBC's Connell Smith in St. John. So what do you think about the alewife story? Give us a call at 1-800-565-5463 or send us an email to marmag@cbc.ca. Now, speaking of your feedback, we received a lot of response to a show we aired recently about the singer-songwriter Laura Smith. In the early 1990s, she was gaining a national profile as an accomplished singer-songwriter, but as the years went on, a series of accidents left her in chronic pain. She eventually became dependent on painkillers, and her music career took a back seat in her life, although she has recently begun touring again. Many of you told us how glad you were to hear Laura's story, and here are just some of the calls that we received.
Hi, this is Giselle Mickey. I'm calling from Moncton. I just heard a show on the radio about Laura Smith, and I always wondered what had happened to her. I had seen her perform in Moncton, and she was wonderful, beautiful, rich voice. I had spoken to her also. So to know that she's gone through so much, now I understand why I haven't heard from her, and you know, what she's been up to, and I'm so happy that she's on the mend after all she's gone through, and she continues to sing and give joy to everyone.
Hi, good morning. It's Pauline Long calling from St. John. I'm calling about the Laura Smith story, and I'm very touched by Laura's story because I didn't know what had happened to her. I had attended a music workshop in St. John in the 90s, and I always liked Laura Smith so much, and suddenly she just disappeared, and I didn't know where she'd gone, and I guess I feel bad now not trying to find out what had happened to her. But Laura has such a beautiful, hauntingly beautiful voice, and I'm proud of her for her recovery. And I just wanted to wish her all the best, and I want to thank CBC for airing that lovely story.
This is Joan Mills calling from Sydney. I thoroughly enjoyed that story and feel so badly for Laura, and I'm so happy that she's on the road to recovery. I enjoy her music so much. Many times I have gone to bed listening to her music, and she's taken me to a place that made me feel so good and comforted. And I really, really pray and hope that she is on the road to recovery, which I think she is. Good luck, Laura.
Thank you so much for those calls. We also received a number of emails, including this one from Masha McKay, who writes, "Heard your piece on Laura this morning. Please pass along to her that her fans think she is wonderful. I didn't realize how ill she had been. In the early days, all my friends in Wolfville would walk a mile to hear Laura. Her music touched us deeply. She sang our spirituality and our women's struggles. Anyone I know has at least two CDs of Laura Smith. Tell her we still love her music and wish her well and happy. Glad to hear you are singing again, Laura. I hope to catch a show sometime soon. Be well and know that you are valuable to many people who have followed your career and love your voice and your songs." And that email was from Masha McKay, and I do hope that we're pronouncing that correctly. Thank you again to everyone who called and wrote. The story about Laura Smith was originally produced for The Current, and you can find it on their website if you want to hear it again. Go to cbc.ca/thecurrent. That's it for us this week. For Christina Harnett and me, thank you for listening.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.